James had made the mistake of telling her what his father and the white man had talked about the day before. "If it weren't for me, would you even have this son?" his father muttered. "What?" his mother said. "I could not understand that ugly Fonte you speak." James rolled his eyes. They would go on like this for the rest of the trip. He could still remember the fights they had when he was a small boy, his mother screaming loudly about his name. "James Richard Collins," his mother would shout. "James Richard Collins, what kind of a con are you that you give your son three white names?" "And so what?" his father would reply. "Will he not still be a prince to our people and to the whites too? I have given him a powerful name." James knew now, as he knew then, that his parents had never loved each other. It was a political marriage. Duty held them together, though even that seemed to be barely enough. By the time they passed the town of Edumfa, his mother was going on about how Quay wouldn't even be a man were it not for James's late great-uncle Fifi. So many of their arguments led to Fifi and the decisions he had made for Quay and their family. After days of travel, they stopped to spend the night in Dumqua with David, a friend from Quay's time in England who had moved back to the Gold Coast years before with his British wife. Days, even weeks, would pass before they reached the interior where James's grandfather's body was being held, so that all could celebrate his life. "Quay, old friend," David said, as James's family approached. He had a round belly like an oversized coconut. For a second, remembering the way he had grown up slicing the fruit and drinking what awaited inside, James wondered what a man like David would spill if punctured. His father and David shook hands and began talking. James always noticed that the longer it had been since the two men saw each other, the louder and more impassioned their voices got, as though the volume was trying to make up for distance, or reach back in time. Nana Yar nodded at David's wife, Catherine, and then loudly cleared her throat. "My wife is very tired," Quay said, and the servants came to show her to her room. James began to walk with them, hoping that he too could get some rest, but David stopped him. "Hey, James, you are a big man now. Sit. Talk." The handful of times James had seen David, David had called him a big man. He could remember back to when he was just 4 years old and had tripped on something invisible, an ant, maybe, and had fallen to the ground, tearing the flesh of his upper lip. He had immediately begun crying, a violent cry that began somewhere inside his chest. David picked him up with one hand, dusted off his butt with the other, and stood him on a table in front of him so that the two were staring eye to eye. "You are a big man now, James. You can't cry at every little thing that comes your way." The three men sat around a fire the servants had built, sipping palm wine. James's father looked older to him, but only slightly, as though the three-day journey had added 3 years. If the trip took 30 days, Quay would look almost as old as James's grandfather had before he died. "So she is still giving you trouble, eh? Even though you are taking her to Osei Bansu's funeral?" David asked. "Nothing is ever enough for this wife of mine," Quay said. "That is what happens when you marry for power instead of marrying for love. The Bible says..." "I don't need to know what the Bible says. I studied the Bible too, remember? In fact, I recall going to religion class more often than you did," Quay said with a short laugh. "I have no use for that religion. I chose this land, these people, these customs, over those of the British."
"You chose it, or it was chosen for you," David said quietly.
Quay stole a glance at James, and then looked away. It was as his mother always yelled at Quay when she was truly angry. "You are so soft. You break apart. Weak man."
"And you, James? You are almost old enough for the marriage festivities to start. Should we begin looking for a bride for you?
Or have you got a woman in mind?" David winked at him, and then, as though the wink were the pulling of a switch that led to his throat, began to laugh so hard he choked on his own spittle.
"Nanaya and I have chosen a nice wife for him to marry when the time comes," Quay said.
David nodded carefully, and tipped the calabash of wine back, his Adam's apple bobbing against the stream of liquid that ran down it. Watching him, James cringed. Before his great-uncle Fifi had died, when James was still just a small boy, Fifi had conspired with Quay to choose the woman whom James would marry. She was called Ama'ata, the daughter of Chief Abeeku Badu's successor to the stool. Their joining would be the last thing on the list of rectifications that Fifi had promised himself he would fulfill for Quay. It would be the realization of a promise that Kobi Otra had made to Effia Otra Collins years ago, that her blood would be joined with the blood of Fanti royals. James would marry her on the eve of his 18th birthday. She would be his first, his most important wife. Because Ama had also grown up in the village, James had known her all his life, and when they were young, he used to play with her outside Chief Abeeku's compound. But the older they got, the more Ama started to annoy him. Little things like the way she always laughed just a second too long after he told a joke. Just long enough for him to know she didn't find him funny at all. Or the way she put so much coconut oil in her hair that if the strands brushed against his shoulder while they were together, his shoulder would continue to smell of oil when they were apart. He was only 15 when he knew that he could never truly love a woman like that. But it didn't matter what he thought. The men continued sipping the wine in silence for a while. In the trees, the birds were calling each other to sleep. A spider crawled over James's bare foot, and he thought of the Anansi stories his mother used to tell him, and still told his younger brothers and sisters. "Have you heard the story of Anansi and the sleeping bird?" she would ask them, mischief dancing behind her eyes, and they would all shout, "No!" and giggle into their hands, thrilled by the lie they were telling, for they had all heard it many times before, learning then that a story was nothing more than a lie you got away with. David tipped the calabash back again, his head tipping back with it so that he could completely empty the contents. He belched, then wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "Is it true?" he asked. "The rumors about the British abolishing slavery soon?" Quay shrugged his shoulders. The year James was born, they told everyone in the castle that the slave trade was abolished, and that we could not sell our slaves to America any more. But did that stop the tribes from selling? Did that make the British leave? Don't you see this war the Ashantis and the British are fighting now, and will continue to fight for far longer than you or I or even James can live to see? There's more at stake here than just slavery, my brother. It's a question of who will own the land, the people, the power. You cannot stick a knife in a goat and then say, 'Now I will remove my knife slowly. So let things be easy and clean. Let there be no mess.' There will always be blood." James had heard this speech or something like it many times before. The British were no longer selling slaves to America. But slavery had not ended, and his father did not seem to think that it would end. They would just trade one type of shackles for another. Trade physical ones that wrapped around wrists and ankles, for the invisible ones that wrapped around the mind. James hadn't understood this when he was younger, when the legal slave exportation had ended and the illegal one had begun. But he understood now. The British had no intention of leaving Africa, even once the slave trade ended. They owned the castle, and, though they had yet to speak it aloud, they intended to own the land as well. They set out again the next morning. James thought his mother looked as though the night's rest had lifted her spirits. She even hummed while they traveled. They passed small towns and villages that were built of little more than mud and sticks. They relied upon the kindness of people whom Quay had once worked with, or cousins of cousins whom Nana Ya had never met. People who offered their floors and a bit of palm wine. The further into the country they moved, the more James noticed how his father's skin attracted attention among the bush people. "Are you a white man?" one little girl asked, reaching out with her index finger and swiping Quay's light brown skin as though she could capture a little bit of the color on it. "What do you think?" Quay had asked, his tree rusty but passable. The little girl giggled, then shook her head slowly before running away to report back to the other children who were gathered around the fire staring, too intimidated to ask him themselves. They reached Kumasi at dusk, and were greeted by Nana Ya's eldest brother, Kofi, and his guards. "Akwaaba," he said. "You are welcome here." They were taken to the new king's large palace, where the servants had prepared a room at the corner of the structure. Kofi sat with them while they ate the welcome food and updated them on what had passed in the town since they had left their own village. "I'm sorry, sister, but we could not wait so long to bury him," Kofi said, and Nana Ya nodded. She had known that the body would be buried before they got there, so that the new king could take office. She had only wanted to make it to the funeral. "And Oseyau?" she asked. Everyone was worried about the new king. Because they were at war, they had had to choose him quickly, just after the burial of James's grandfather, and no one knew whether or not this would be bad luck for the people and the war that they were fighting. "He is doing a fine job as a Sante Hene," Kofi said. "Don't worry, little sister. He will make sure our father is honored as he should be honored." As his uncle spoke, James noticed that Kofi paid no attention to his father. His eyes never once reached Kwe's eyes, not even when wandering. He was like the blind cat that moved through the dark forest solely on instinct, avoiding the logs and rocks that threatened it or had hurt it once before. The funeral proceedings began the next day. Nana Ya left the palace long before James and the other men were awake so that she could join with the women of the family in mournful wailing. Wailing that announced to everyone in the town that the celebration day had indeed arrived. By noon, these women were dressed in their red cloths, nyanya leaves, and raffia braided about their clay-stained foreheads as they walked up and down the streets, wailing for all the townspeople to hear. In the meantime, James, his father, and all of the other men put on their black and red mourning cloths. There was a line of drummers that began at one corner of the royal palace and ended at the other. They would drum until dawn. The men began chanting, then dancing the kete, the adwa, the dansumu. They would dance until dawn. The dead king's family sat in a row so that they could be greeted by all the mourners as they came in. A single file line of people began at James's grandfather's first wife and went all the way into the middle of the town square. Everyone in line shook the hand of each family member and offered their condolences. James stood next to his father. He tried to remember to keep his shoulders squared, and to look each mourner directly in the eyes so that they knew he was a man whose blood was as important as they expected it to be. They shook his hand and murmured their sorries, and James accepted, even though he had never lived in Ashantiland, and had known his grandfather only as a person knows his shadow, as a figure that is there, visible but untouchable, unknowable. By the time the last of the mourners were coming through, the sun was at its highest point in the sky. James reached up briefly to wipe sweat out of his eyes, and once he had, he opened them to the loveliest girl he had ever seen. "May the old king find peace in the land of the spirits," the girl said. But she did not reach for his hand.
"What's this?" James asked. "You do not shake?"
"Respectfully, I will not shake the hand of a slaver," she said. She looked him in the eye as she spoke, and James studied her face. Her hair was worn in a puff at the top of her head, and her words had whistled through a gap between her front teeth. Though her mourning cloth was wrapped tightly, it had slid a little low so that James could just make out the tops of her breasts. He should have slapped her for her insolence, reported her, but the line continued on behind her and the funeral had to continue too. James let her move on, tried to watch her as she continued down the line, but before long, he lost her in the crowd. He lost her, but he could not forget her, even as the line moved on and the rest of the people came by to shake his hand. James was by turns annoyed and ashamed by what she had said. Did she shake his father's hand? His uncle's? Who was she to decide what a slaver was? James had spent his whole life listening to his parents argue about who was better, Ashanti or Fanti. But the matter could never come down to slaves. The Ashanti had power from capturing slaves. The Fanti had protection from trading them. If the girl could not shake his hand, then surely she could never touch her own. They finally laid Ose Bansu, the old king, to rest. The gong was rung to let the townspeople know that it was done, that they could all return to their normal lives. It would not be over for the family members for another 40 days. For another 40 days, they would wear the mourning clothes, sort through and divide the gifts, and worry over the king's successor. James's parents would be leaving within the next couple of days, and James knew that he didn't have much time to find the girl who had refused to shake his hand. He went to his cousin Kwame. Kwame was approaching 20 years old and had already married twice. He was a fat, dark man who spoke loudly and drank often, but he was kind and loyal. James and his family had visited once when James was only 7. He and Kwame had been playing in their grandfather's golden stool room, a room men had been killed for entering uninvited, a room that had been expressly forbidden to them. While playing, James had knocked over one of their grandfather's canes. In one of those coincidences that could only be attributed to evil spirits, the cane had landed in the palm oil lamp, catching fire, and the two boys had worked quickly to put it out. Smelling the fire, the whole family had come to see what was going on.
"Who is responsible for this?"
their grandfather shouted. He had been the Ashanti king so long that his voice seemed no longer human, more like the roar of a lion. James had looked down immediately, expecting Kwame to tell on him. He was the outsider, only in town once every few years. Kwame was the one who had to live there, with their lion of a grandfather and his quick, powerful rage. But Kwame had said nothing. Even as their mothers laid them across their laps and beat them in unison, Kwame still had said nothing.
"Kwame, I need to find a girl," Jane said.
"Hey, cousin, you have come to the right place," Kwame said, laughing loudly. "I know every girl who walks this town. Describe her to me." So James did, and when he finished, his cousin told him who she was and where he could find her. James went out into the town he barely knew, looking for the girl he'd met but once. He knew his cousin would keep his secret for him. When James found her, she was carrying water in a bucket on the top of her head, heading back toward her family's hut. She did not seem surprised to see him, and he was confident that whatever he'd felt during their brief time together, she had felt too.
"Can I help you with that?" James asked, pointing to the bucket. She shook her head, horrified. "No, please. You shouldn't be doing this kind of work."
"Call me James."
"James," she repeated, rolling the strange name around in her mouth, tasting it as though it were bitter melon hitting the back of her tongue. "James."
"And you are?"
"Okosia Mensa," she said. The two kept walking. The few townspeople who recognized James stopped to bow or stare, but mostly people went about their daily lives, fetching water and carrying wood back for their fires. It was a 10-mile walk from the stream to Okosia's hut in the bush on the outskirts of town, and James was determined to learn everything there was to know about her.
"Why would you not shake my hand at the king's funeral?" James asked. "I told you, I will not shake the hand of a Fanti slaver."
"And am I a slaver?" James asked, trying to keep his anger from entering his voice. "If I am Fanti, am I not also a Shanti? Was my grandfather not your king?"
She smiled at him. "I am one of 13 children. Now there are only 10 of us who remain. When I was a small girl, there was war between my village and another. They took 3 of my brothers." They walked in silence for a few minutes longer. James was sorry for her loss, but he knew too that all loss was just a part of life. Even his mother, important as she was, had once been captured, stolen from her family, and planted in another's. "If your village had won that war, would you not have taken 3 of someone else's brothers?" James asked, unable to resist the question. Akosia looked away. The bucket on her head was so steady, James wondered what it would take to knock it down. Maybe wind? Maybe an insect?
"I know what you are thinking," she finally said. "Everyone is part of this. Ashanti, Fanti, Ga, British, Dutch, and American. And you are not wrong to think like this. It is how we are all taught to think. But I do not want to think this way. When my brothers and the other people were taken, my village mourned them as we redoubled our military efforts. And what does that say? We avenge lost lives by taking more. It doesn't make sense to me." They stopped walking so that she could adjust her wrapper. For the second time that day, James tried as hard as he could not to look at her breasts. She continued, "I love my people, James," she said, and his name on her tongue was indescribably sweet. "I am proud to be Ashanti, as I am sure you are proud to be Fanti. But after I lost my brothers, I decided that as for me, Akosia, I will be my own nation." As James listened to her speak, he felt something well up inside him as it had never done before. If he could, he would listen to her speak forever. If he could, he would join that nation she spoke of. They walked farther. The sun was getting even lower in the sky, and James knew it would be impossible for him to make it home before nightfall. Still, they slowed down so that it seemed their feet were not even moving at all, really, just coasting slowly, as though their bodies were being lifted and flown awkwardly by the mosquitoes they could feel buzzing around them. "Are you promised to anyone?" James asked. Akosha glanced shyly at him. "My father does not believe in promising a girl before her body has shown that she is ready, and I have not yet received my blood." James thought about his own wife-to-be back home in his village, selected for him because of her status. He would never be happy with her, and his marriage would be as loveless and biting as that of his parents. But he knew his parents would never approve of Akosha, not even as a third or fourth wife. She had nothing, and she came from nowhere. Nothing from nowhere. It was something his grandmother Ephia used to say on nights when she seemed most sad. James couldn't remember a day when he hadn't seen Ephia in all black, nor a night when he hadn't heard her faint crying. When he was still just a small boy, he'd spent a weekend with her at a house near the castle. In the middle of the night, he had woken up and heard her crying in her room. He'd gone to her and wrapped her into a hug as tight as his little arms could muster. "Why are you crying, Mama?" he'd asked, touching his fingers to her face, trying to catch some of the tears to blow and make a wish on, as his mother sometimes did when he cried. "Have you heard the story of Baba, my own?" she asked, pulling him up onto her lap and rocking him back and forth. That was the first night James heard it, but it wasn't the last. Now James grabbed Akosia's hand, stopped her from moving. The bucket on her head began to sway, and she lifted her hands to steady it. "I want to marry you," James said. They were only steps away from the girl's hut. He could see it through the bushes. Young children were wrestling with each other in the mud, coming up with their faces caked in brown. A man stood, chopping the tall grass with his machete. Each time the blade hit the ground, it shook the earth. James thought he could feel it move under his feet. "How can you marry me, James?" the girl said. She looked worried now, her eyes stealing over to where her family waited. If she was too late with the water, her mother would beat her, then yell at her until dawn. No one would believe that she had been with the Ashanti king's grandson, and if they did believe it, they would only smell trouble. "When your blood comes, you must tell no one. You must hide it. I am leaving tomorrow, but I will come back for you, and we will leave this town together. Start a new life in a small village where no one knows us." Akosha was still looking at her family, and he knew how crazy he sounded, and he knew how much he was asking her to give up. The Ashanti puberty rites were a serious matter. There was a week-long ceremony to bless the girl's fresh womanhood. The rules thereafter were strict. Women in menses could not visit the stoolhouses, could not cross certain rivers. They lived in separate houses and painted their wrists with white clay on the days they bled. If anyone found a woman had bled but not told, the punishment would be great. "Do you trust me?" James asked, knowing it was a question he had no right to ask. "No," Akosha answered finally. "Trust is a thing to be earned. I don't trust you. I have seen what power can do to men, and you are from one of the most powerful families." James's head grew light. He felt faint, like he would soon fall. "But," Akosha continued, "if you come back for me, then you will earn my trust." James nodded slowly, understanding. He would be back in his village by the end of the month, at his own wedding by the end of the year. The war would continue, and nothing, not his life, nor his heart, was guaranteed. But listening to Akosia speak, he knew he would make a way. James could not explain to Amma why he did not want to sleep in her hut. They had been married for 3 months, and his excuses were wearing thin. On their wedding night, he had told her he was ill. For the entire week after, his body had taken over the excuse-making for him, his penis lying limp between his legs each time he went to her. Even on the nights she braided her hair the way he liked it, and rubbed coconut oil on her breasts and between her thighs. After that week, he had spent another 2 pretending to be too embarrassed to go to her. But soon, that too had failed him. "You must go to see the apothecary. There are herbs you can take to help with this. If I do not get pregnant soon, people will start to believe there is something wrong with me," Amma said. He felt bad for her. It was true. Failure to conceive was always believed to be the woman's fault, a punishment for infidelity or loose morals. But in these few short months, James had gotten to know his wife well. She would soon tell everyone in the village that there was something wrong with him, and word would get back to his father and mother that he had not fulfilled his husbandly duties. He could hear his mother now. "Oh, Nyame, what have I done to deserve this? First a weak husband, and now a weak son." James knew he would have to figure something out soon if he wanted to remain faithful to the memory of Akosia. It was a memory he gripped tightly. It had been nearly a year since James had promised Akosia that he would come back for her, and he had come no closer to creating a plan to fulfill that promise. The Ashantis were winning battle after battle against the British, and the people of his village had begun to murmur that maybe the Ashantis would win against the white men. And then what? Would more white men come to replace the ones who had died? Who would protect them if the Ashantis came to meet them, to finally exact revenge for Abeku Badu and Fifi's grievances toward them? They had made an alliance with the British so long ago, maybe the white man had already forgotten. James had not forgotten Akosia. He could see her every night when he slept, her lips and eyes and legs and buttocks moving across the field of his closed eyes. In his own hut, on the outer edge of the compound, which he had built for himself and Amma and the other wives who were supposed to follow, he had not forgotten how much he had loved being in his grandfather's town, among the Ashantis, the warmth he'd felt from his mother's people. The longer he stayed in Fantiland, the sooner he wished to get away, to lead a simpler life, as a farmer, like Akosia's father, not as a politician like his own father, whose work for the British and the Fantis so many years before had left him with money and power, but little else. "James, are you listening to me?" Amma said. She was stirring a pot of pepper soup, a wrapper slung across her waist, her back leaning forward so that it seemed her bare breasts would dip into the broth. "Yes, darling, you are right," James said. "Tomorrow I will go to see Mam Peng." Amma nodded her head, satisfied. Mam Peng was the premier apothecary for hundreds of miles around. Junior wives went to her when they wished to quietly kill the senior wives. Younger brothers went when they wanted to be chosen as successor over their elder brothers. From the ocean's edge to the inland forests, people went to her when they had a problem that prayers alone could not fix. James saw her on a Thursday. His father and many others had always called the woman a witch doctor, and she seemed to physically embody that role. She was missing all but her four front teeth, evenly spaced, as though they had chased all of the other teeth out of her mouth and then joined together in the middle, triumphant. Her back was perpetually hunched forward, and she walked with a cane made out of a rich black wood, carved to look like a snake was coiled around it. One of her eyes always looked away, and try as hard as he might, moving his head this way and that, James could not convince that eye to greet him.
"What is this man doing here?"
Mom Payne asked the heir. James cleared his throat, unsure if he should speak. Mom Payne spit on the ground, more phlegm than saliva.
"What does this man want with Mom Payne? Can he not leave her in peace? He who does not even believe in her powers."
"Auntie Mom Payne, I have come from my village at my wife's request. She would like me to take some herbs so that we can make a baby." He had rehearsed a speech on the journey there about how he wanted to make his wife happy, while also making himself happy. But the words eluded him. He could hear the uncertainty, the fear, in his voice, and he cursed himself for it.
"Eh? He calls me auntie. He whose family sells our people to the whites abroad, he dares to call me auntie.
That was my father and grandfather's work. It is not mine." He didn't add that because of their work, he didn't have to work, but instead could live off the family name and power. She watched him with her good eye.
"In your mind, you call me witch, eh?"
"Everyone calls you witch."
"Tell me, is Mom Payne the one who lay down for a white man to open her legs?"
"The white man might have left had they not tasted our women."
"The white man will stay until there is no more money to be made." "Ah, now you speak of money. Mom Payne has already said she knows how your family makes money."
"By sending your brothers and sisters over to Abu Roltre to be treated like animals."
"America is not the only place with slaves," James said quietly. He'd heard his father say it to David before, when they talked about the atrocities of the American South that he'd read about in the abolitionist British papers.
"The way they treat the slaves in America, my brother," David had said, "it is unfathomable. Unfathomable. We do not have slavery like that here, not like that."
James's skin was starting to feel warm, but the sun had already dipped underneath the earth. He wished he could turn and leave. Mom Payne's wandering eye had landed on a tree in the distance, then moved up to the sky, then just past James's left ear.
"I don't want to do the work of my family. I don't want to be one with the British."
She spit again, and then focused her roving eye directly onto him, and he began to sweat. Once she had finished, her eye returned to its ambling, finally satisfied with what it had seen in him.
"Your penis does not work because you don't want it to work.
My medicine is only for those who want. You speak of what you don't want. But there is something you want."
It was not a question. James didn't think he could trust her, and yet he knew that with her bad eye, she had seen him. Really seen him. And since he had not been able to make the earth move on his own, he decided to trust the witch doctor to help him move it.
"I want to leave my family and move to Ashantiland. I want to marry Akosia Mensa and work as a farmer or something small."
Mom Payne laughed. "This son of big man wants to live small, eh?"
She left him standing outside and went into her hut. When she came back, she was carrying two small clay pots that had flies buzzing around the tops of them. James could smell them from where he stood. She sat on a chair and began swirling her index finger inside one of the pots. She pulled her finger back out and licked what was on it. James gagged. "If you do not want your wife, why did you marry her?" Mampeng asked. "I was required to marry her so that our families could finally join," James said. "Wasn't it obvious? She herself had said it. He was the son of a big man. There were things he had to do, things he had to be seen doing, so that everyone would know that his family was still important. What he wanted, what he most wanted, was to disappear. His father had seven other sons who could carry on the Ultra Collins legacy. He wanted to be a man without a name. "I want to leave my family without them knowing I have left them," he said. Mampeng spit into the pot and then mixed it again. Her good eye looked up at James. "Is this possible?" "Auntie, they say that you make impossible things possible." She laughed again. "Eh, but they say that about Anansi, about Inyame, about the white man. I can only make the possible attainable. Do you see the difference?" He nodded and she smiled, the first smile she'd given him since his arrival. She beckoned him toward her, and he went, hoping that she would not ask him to eat whatever it was that was stinking in the pot. She motioned for him to sit before her, and he did so wordlessly. His parents would not like how he was stooped below her in her seat, so that it seemed that she was a higher-born one than him. He could hear his mother's voice saying, "Stand." But he kept kneeling. Perhaps Mampeng could make it so that neither his mother's voice nor his father's would ever be in his head again. "You have come here asking me what to do, but you already know how to leave without anyone knowing you've left," Mampeng said. James was quiet. It was true he had thought of ways to make his family think he'd gone to Asamando, when really he had journeyed elsewhere. The best idea, the most dangerous, was to join the never-ending Ashanti-British War. Everyone knew about the war, how it seemed it would never end, how the white men were weaker than everyone had once thought, even with their large castle made of stone. "People think they are coming to me for advice," Mampeng said. "But really, they come to me for permission. If you want to do something, do it. The Ashantis will be in Efutu soon. This I know." She was no longer looking at him. Instead, she focused on the contents of the pot. There was no way this woman could know what the plans of the Ashantis were. Theirs was the most powerful army in all of Africa. It was said that when the white men first came upon the Ashanti warriors with their bare chests and their loose cloth wraps, they had laughed, saying, "Are these not the cloths our women would wear?" They had prided themselves on their guns and their uniforms, the button-down jackets and trousers. Then the Ashantis had slaughtered them by the hundreds, cut out the hearts of their military leaders, and eaten them for strength. After that, at least one British soldier could be seen wetting those trousers they once praised as he retreated from the men they once underestimated. If all that they said about the Ashanti army was true, it was impossible that they would be poorly organized enough to let a Fanti fetish woman know of their plans. James knew that her roving eye had found itself in Efutu, in the future, and had seen him there, just as it had seen his heart's desire just then. But still James did not go to Efutu. Amma was waiting for him when he went back home.
"What did Mom Payne say?" his wife asked.
"She said, 'You must be patient with me,' he said, and his wife huffed, dissatisfied. James knew she would spend the rest of the day gossiping with her girlfriends about him. For a week, James was miserable. He started to have doubts about Okosia, about his wish to live a small life. Was his life now so bad? He could stay in the village. He could continue the work of his father. James had all but decided to do this when his grandmother came over to eat one night. Efia was an old lady, and yet it was still possible to see the youth that once was somewhere beneath the many lines of her face. She had insisted on living in Cape Coast, in the house her husband had built, even after Quay had grown prominent in her village. She said she would never again live in the village that Evil had built. As they all ate outside in Quay's compound, James could feel his grandmother watching him, and after the house girls and boys had all come to collect their dishes, and James's father and mother had retired for the evening, he could feel his grandmother watching him still. "What's wrong, my own child?" she asked when the two of them were finally alone. James didn't speak. The fufu they had eaten sat like a rock at the bottom of his belly, and he thought it would make him sick. He looked at his grandmother. They said she was once so beautiful that the castle governor would have burned the whole village down just to get to her. She touched the black stone necklace she wore at her neck and then reached for James's hand. "You are not content?" she asked. And James could feel the pressure build behind his eyes as tears threatened to break through. He squeezed his grandmother's hand. "I've heard my mother call my father weak my whole life. But what if I'm just like him?" James said. He expected his grandmother to react, but she remained silent. "I want to be my own nation." He knew she wouldn't be able to understand what he said, and yet it seemed that she had heard him. Even though he spoke in a whisper, she heard him. His grandmother didn't speak at first, just watched him. "We are all weak, most of the time," she said finally. "Look at the baby. Born to his mother, he learns how to eat from her, how to walk, talk, hunt, run. He does not invent new ways. He just continues with the old. This is how we all come to the world, James. Weak and needy. Desperate to learn how to be a person." She smiled at him. "But if we do not like the person we have learned to be, should we just sit in front of our fufu, doing nothing? I think, James, that maybe it is possible to make a new way." She kept smiling. The sun was setting behind them, and James finally let himself cry in front of his grandmother. And so, the next day, James told his family that he was going back to Cape Coast with Efia. But instead, he went to Efutu. He found work with a doctor whom his grandmother knew, who had worked for the British when she lived in the castle. All James had to do was tell him that he was James Collins's grandson, and he immediately received work and a place to stay. The doctor was Scottish, and so old he could hardly walk upright, let alone heal illnesses without catching them. He had moved to Efutu after working for the company for only 1 year. He spoke fluent Fanti. had built his compound himself from the ground up, and had remained unmarried, even though many of the local women had brought their young daughters to him as offerings. To the townspeople he was a mystery, but they had grown fond of him, affectionately calling him the White Doctor. It was James's job to help keep the medicine room clean. The White Doctor's medical hut was next door to his living quarters, and it was small enough so that he didn't really need James's help at all. James swept, organized the medicines, washed the rags. Sometimes, in the evenings, he would cook a simple meal for the two of them, and they would sit in the yard, facing the dirt stretch of road, while the White Doctor told stories about his time in the castle.
"You look just like your grandmother. What was that the locals used to call her?"
He scratched his fine white hair.
"The beauty. Ephia. The beauty, right?"
James nodded, trying to see her through the doctor's eyes.
"Your grandfather was so excited to marry her.
I remember the night before she was to come to the castle. We took James over to the company store just as the sun was going down, and drank up almost all of the new liquor shipment. James had to tell the bosses back in England that the ship that had transported the liquor had sunk or been taken over by pirates. Something like that. It was a great night for all of us. A little rabble-rousing in Africa." A dreamy look came over his face, and James wondered if the old man had gotten the adventure he seemed to have been chasing here in the Gold Coast. In a month, James would get what he had been chasing. The call came in the middle of the night, fast-paced, high-pitched panting and shrieking, as the watchman, Evefutu, went from hut to hut, shouting that the Ashantis were coming. The British and Fanti armies stationed there sent out word for backup to join them, but the panic in the watchman's eyes told James that the Ashantis were closer than any help could be. Already by that point, villages throughout Fantiland, Garland, and Denchira had been living in fear of Ashanti raids. British soldiers had been stationed intermittently in the towns and villages surrounding Cape Coast. Their goal was to keep the Ashantis from storming the castle, lest they do it successfully. But Efutu, only a week's journey from the coast, was far too close for comfort.
"You must run!" James shouted at the White Doctor.
The old man had lit a palm oil lamp next to his cot and pulled out a leather-bound book, reading with his spectacles perched at the tip of his nose.
"They will kill you when they see you. They will not care that you are old."
The White Doctor turned the page. He didn't look up at James as he waved goodbye. James shook his head and left the hut. Mompain had told him that he would know what to do when the time came. And yet here he was, so panicked that he could hardly breathe. He could feel the warm liquid traveling down his legs as he ran. He could not think. He could not think quickly enough to devise a plan, and before he knew it, shots were being fired all around him. The birds took flight, a black and red and blue and green cloud of wings ascending. James wanted to hide. He couldn't remember what had been so bad about his old life. He could learn to love Amma. He'd spent so much time seeing the bad in his parents' marriage that he'd assumed there had to be something better. What if there wasn't? He had trusted a witch with his happiness, with his life. Now he would surely die. James woke up in the bush of some unknown forest. His arms and legs ached, and his head felt as though it had been beaten by a rock. He sat there, disoriented, for countless minutes. Then an Ashanti warrior was beside him, so quiet in his approach that James did not notice him until he was standing over him.
"You are not dead," the warrior asked. "Are you hurt?"
How could James tell a warrior like this that he had a headache?
He said, "No."
"You are Ose Bansu's grandson, are you not? I remember you from his funeral. I have never forgotten a face." James wished he would lower his voice, but he didn't say anything.
"What were you doing in Efutu?" the warrior asked.
"Does anyone know I'm alive?" James asked, ignoring the man's question.
"No. A warrior hit your head with a rock. You didn't move, so they threw you in the dead pile. We aren't supposed to touch the pile. But I recognized your face and took you out so that I could send your body back to your people. I hid you here so no one would know I touched the dead."
"I didn't know you were still alive."
"Listen to me. I died in this war," James said.
The man's eyes grew so wide they looked like echoes of the moon.
"What?"
"You must tell everyone that I died in this war. Will you do that?" The warrior shook his head. He said no over and over and over again. But ultimately, he would do it. James knew he would do it. And when he did it, it would be the last time James would ever use his power to make another do his bidding. For the rest of the month, James traveled to Ashantiland. He slept in caves and hid in trees. He asked for help when he saw people in the bushland, telling them he was a lowly farmer who had gotten lost. And when he finally got to Okosia, on the 40th day of his travels, he found her waiting for him.
Kojo. Somebody had robbed old Alice, which meant the police would come sniffing around the boat, asking all the ship workers if they knew anything about it. Joe's reputation was spotless. He'd been working on the ships in Fells Point for nearly 2 years, and had never given anybody any trouble. But still, whenever a boat was robbed, all the black dock workers were rounded up and questioned. Joe was tired of it. He was always jumpy around police or anyone in uniform. Even the appearance of the postman had once sent him running behind a lace curtain. Ma Aku said he'd been like this since their days in the woods, running from catchers, from town to town, until they'd hit the safe house in Maryland. "Cover for me, would you, Poot?" Joe asked his friend, but he knew the police wouldn't miss him. They couldn't tell one black face from another. Poot would answer when they called his own name, and then answer when they called Joe's too, and they wouldn't know the difference. Joe jumped off the boat and looked behind him at the beautiful Chesapeake Bay, at the large, imposing ships that lined the Fells Point shipyards. He loved the look of those boats, loved that his hands helped build and maintain them. But Ma Aku always said it was bad juju. Him and all the other freed Negroes working on ships. She said there was something evil about them building up the things that had brought them to America in the first place. The very things that had tried to drag them under. Joe walked down Market Street and bought some pig's feet from Jim at the corner store near the museum. As he was leaving, a horse broke free from its buggy and ran wild, nearly trampling an old white woman who had been lifting her skirt, just about to step into the street. "You all right, ma'am?" Joe asked, running over to her and offering his arm. She looked dazed for a second, but then she smiled at Joe.
"Fine, thank you," she said.
He continued on. Anna would still be cleaning house with Ma Aku. He knew he should go over there and help the two women, what with Anna being pregnant again, and my Aku being so old the never-ending coughs and aches had set in. But it had been too long since he'd let himself enjoy Baltimore. The cool sea breeze, the Negroes